Well, if you are familiar with the academic discipline of Christian apologetics, you're probably aware that there are different approaches to the subject. That is to say, there are different apologetic methods, different ways of conceptualizing both the nature and the practice of apologetics. And one such method that has serious appeal within certain traditions of Protestantism is called presuppositional apologetics. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Now, joining me in this conversation is Think for Christ's contributor, Dr. Andrew Payne, and returning guest to the show, Dr. Richard Howe. Gentlemen, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks, man. This is a thrill for me. I appreciate it so much.
Well, I've been really looking forward to this. Richard, when Andrew and I talked about doing an episode on the subject of presuppositional apologetics, you immediately came to my mind. In my estimation, I think you're one of the leading voices in this, what really is an in-house yet public conversation over apologetic method generally and presuppositional apologetics specifically. So it's a real honor to have you here to guide us in this discussion.
Well, that's such a nice thing to say. You know, part of that, I may stand out only because the conversation has moved so far downstream. People aren't having this debate, except the presuppositionalists are still going on YouTube and defending their model. But it seems like a lot of ways it's kind of run its course. Everybody's chosen their sides. But I'm still over here ranting and raving and stomping my feet every chance I get. So I get a lot of attention.
Well, we're glad to have you here. So, Richard, could you set the stage for us by situating presuppositional apologetics within the broader subject of Christian apologetical method? So basically, what is this thing called presuppositionalism? Where does it come from? And how does it relate to other ways of doing apologetics?
You know, one might be struck to some extent when they listen to presuppositionalists try to define their own model, because in their defense, it has a lot of technicalities and particular data points that they all want to have something to say about. So it's hard to try to see, well, can we bring those under a single heading? One of the things it's not, and I think this is a understandable misunderstanding that people have, is that somehow presuppositionalism means that you do a critique of the presuppositions that people might be laboring under. Well, of course, nobody doesn't do that. No system that I know of wouldn't try to be cognizant of presupposition. For example, if someone like a Richard Dawkins is so blinded by his materialism, philosophical materialism, where he thinks everything that's real operates according to the laws of the material universe, if he's laboring under that so much so that he's not even aware of it, then obviously in a debate, if one had with him, they'd have to observe that and point that out and say, well, one of your problems with dealing with the evidence is that you're a material, that kind of stuff. So I, as far as I know, no apologetic method would differ in that regard. So, even more interesting, the title presuppositionalism was more or less given to it by probably its detractors, maybe. You know, a lot of monikers that get attached to systems are given to it, like theistic personalism. The theistic personalists don't like that expression, but the classical theists always use that expression. Eventually, it'll probably just get settled. Methodists were called Methodists because of their scrupulous attention to method in their ecclesiology and such. Excuse me. So it eventually got attached to this method. So basically what they try to point out is, Bahnsen puts it this way. Greg Bahnsen was one of Cornelius Van Til, the sort of fountainhead of presuppositionalism. He defines it as that the presupposition of God, the Trinitarian God of the 66 books of the Bible, the Protestant Reformed Bible, I mean, you could just really attenuate it. The presupposition of God is the necessary condition or precondition of intelligibility. So without the presupposition of the God of the Bible, then intelligibility itself would not be possible. And so what they try to do is they take a cue from the proverb that says, answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be, you know, caught up in his deceit, or what, I forget exactly how it's worded. And then the next phrase is, answer the fool according to the folly. And so they take that as their template. They answer not the fool in the sense that you don't grant the truth of some of the assumptions that unbelievers may have, because, not to pile too much into the definition you ask, it's grounded in their really, really strident Reformed theology. So they have such a view of the noetic effects of sin from the fall, how it's affected our mind, that the lost man is in constant rebellion against God. And so you don't want to buy into a lot of the false views that characterize this rebellion against God. But at the same time, you might want to assume, for the sake of argument, some of those things to try to show the lost man that his model of reality, absent God, is internally incoherent. So that's what they want to do. So the term presupposition gets attached to that because those are presuppositions in some sense, right? That the lost man is coming to the equation about life and ethics and things with these background assumptions, if you will. And so that's how the term gets attached to the model.
Andrew, anything to add there? Oh, we just lost you.
No, I had it muted, and then I
Okay.
yeah, that's my mistake. Nothing really to add there. In terms of just a basic summary here, that was fantastic. I do increasingly wonder. There's a couple of questions I want to run by Richard, and I don't know if now's the time to jump in with some of those, but
Well, before we get to those questions,
okay.
maybe we can further explicate presuppositionalism by situating it in contrast to this thing called classical apologetics. So maybe, Richard, can you explain the difference between, let's say, a classical model of apologetics versus this presupposition? What are the distinguishing characteristics?
Well, there's two prongs to this answer. One is, well, how does the presuppositionalist see themselves in contradistinction to the classical? The other, though, is in actual doing apologetics, how are they distinctive? What is it that they do? And I may be anomalous in this observation, but I insist upon the fact, because this has just been my experience, having become familiar with Van Til in the 70s as a college student, and off and on studying these things, I have never seen in writing or heard in talking a presuppositionalist that once they actually start trying to do apologetics, I've never seen them fail to do exactly what the classical apologist does. Because even in their principle of, well, you assume for the sake of argument to try to show the lost man, for example, if he's a materialist, how is he going to count for universals or laws of logic? And even last night, I was listening to a YouTuber, one of my favorite YouTubers in presuppositionalism. And as soon as he tried to explain, well, this is what we do and this is how we use evidence, they end up doing exactly what the classical apologist was already doing all along, trying to show the lost person certain maybe assumptions, maybe conclusions they have about the nature of reality cannot ultimately be accounted for minus the existence of God and his act of creation and his attributes and these kind of things. That all of that is the ultimate explanation of why these things are. Now, personally, I would even differ from some other classical apologists as to how that looks because of my Thomism as a
Sure.
philosophical realist, and I know you guys would be the same thing. So downstream, even the classical apologists might differ from each other in exactly what does it look like. But in principle, we look the same in terms of trying to show God as the best explanatory hypothesis, or the inference to the those kind of thing
Yeah.
versus a flat out demonstration. So what they try to do is show that here's I don't excuse me, I'm choking up here. Excuse me. I don't want to jump ahead, but I'll throw this little salvo out.
Sure.
When you actually see how they do their critique, let me see if I can think of the example I was thinking of a while ago. When they, for example, when Bahnsen, in his debate with R.C. Sproul, if you guys have heard that thing, we watch or we listen to that debate in my apologetic systems course when we're talking about presuppositionalism, and do a critique. Bahnsen, within one paragraph, says the presupposition of God is the precondition of intelligibility. And then in the very next sentence, to explain that and defend that, he goes, because if God didn't exist, and I go, wait a minute, there's a difference between the presupposition of God and God. It would be like someone saying, you would have to have oxygen in the air in order to breathe. Well, that's true. That's just an ontological observation. But you don't have to presuppose that there's oxygen in the air. You can actually deny the reality of oxygen while you're breathing, but your denial of it is just an epistemological thing. So I see, again, I don't mean to jump ahead in my critique.
No.
See, it's hard to, well, how do what they do differ from what we do? I go, when it gets to the nuts and bolts, it doesn't differ. It only differs in some kind of abstract, kind of definitional kind of way. But when they actually start doing it, they find themselves having to show the atheist why he can't account for morality or why he can't account for logic or anything else. You go, well, it's kind of what we were already doing. Not sure how this becomes distinctively presuppositional. And I actually have a list of those like Bahnsen, just example after example from Bantil, from other presuppositionalists, which we can get into some of those examples if you want. But the point is the same. I think they're
Sure,
not
sure.
consistent in their practice, what they adamantly affirm in their principles.
Yeah.
Personally, I don't.
Great. Thanks for that. So in a minute here, I think I want to try to drive us into the heart of presuppositionalism, kind of their fundamental commitments. But before I do that, Andrew, did you have some comments or questions for Dr. Howe?
Yeah. For a clarification point, the statement that you've repeated several times now for the definition is that it's necessary to presuppose the triune God of the scriptures, right? And
yeah.
That's the claim that's oftentimes made. And the thing I repeatedly read with Van Til as well, and I know Van Til, like Vantillians like to use the word worldview. He didn't really like that one. He liked to use the word like system, Christian system, something like that. When usually he refers to it as the systematic theology, right? Like, I mean, his intro to systematic theology, that's essentially
right.
What he's talking about. We need to presuppose. And I don't think it's a controversial thing to say systematic theology does not reduce to the Trinity. Right. And so with Van Til, you'll read several times that you must presuppose the Christian system. So is there a distinction that needs to be made? Is that a point that is that presuppositionalists are kind of in friction over? Or is that just that they're conflating like that you need to presuppose the triune God and the Christian system as if these two are the same thing?
Well, it's interesting because when I first stumbled on the fact that Van Til put such emphasis on not just the presupposition of God, but the presupposition of the ontological Trinity, he put such emphasis on that. And then there were a few that started following suit recently, kind of making the same argument. But it struck me as like, okay, well, that wasn't obvious from the beginning of reading precepts. But all of a sudden, I started to see that. And then one of the things that hit me was, Bahnsen never seemed to have made that point that I ever found. Now, in it might very well be because he died at a young age. Unfortunately for the rest of the world, he died, I think, in his mid-40s from heart condition. So maybe he just didn't write long enough, you know, to actually fold in this idea of the systematic theology and the Trinity. So I thought, well, so all along I was thinking, I guess it didn't matter that much to Bahnsen, or he didn't see that implication, that it has to be grounded not just in theism, but Trinitarian theism. Well, lo and behold, the book that was published posthumously, you may know the story, were some years, I think, after Bahnsen died, and they're cleaning out an office, they found a manuscript that had fallen down behind the filing cabinet. Turns out he was in the process of writing a book.
Was it this one, so, Richard?
Yes, that one right there, Presuppositional Apologetics. So his disciples rounded it out, brought it to completion, and published it. Well, in there, he actually does visit that same point. That has to be the Trinitarian, the God of Trinitarian theism and such. So, but I see that seldom really touted. One of the direct applications I think it has for Van Til and maybe a few others I'll try to think of is that they think, and this gets us into another issue, so I don't want to say too much
Go
about
for it.
Get into it. And that is, over the years, I've discovered, you know, 7 or 8 philosophical problems that presuppositionalists insist only presuppositionalism solves.
Yeah.
And like 7 of those 8 problems, I'm putting it in scare quotes here, are created by modern and contemporary analytic philosophy. They're not problems in classical realism, like the problem of induction, for example. The only one that has antiquity is the problem of the one and the many. And so I was startled to discover that James White, I think, does this, certainly Van Til does, that he thinks that the Trinity the persons of the Trinity, the plurality of the personhood and the unity of the substance solves the problem of the one and the many. I don't think so. I mean, that would be like saying the Godhead is a universal of which the persons of the Trinity are individuated instantiations, like a tree is an instantiation of the form tree, right? I didn't think that was true, but that was the only one that has antiquity because that goes all the way back to Plato and Aristotle. Aristotle calls it the problem of the one over the many. But at any rate, it was weird. And then another issue, I throw out another salvo, we can come back to it, was Van Til's bizarre statement about the Trinity, where he says there's one person in the Godhood. Be sure to ask me about what Scott Oliphant does with that, because Scott takes it downfield, down the field of heresy even more than anybody thought Van Til did. I think a lot of Van Tilians just say, well, it was just an unguarded statement. He didn't mean there's only that it's, what it sounds like there's only one person in the Godhead. He didn't mean that. Say, okay, it's the only place I know that he says that. But you should see what Scott Oliphant, we'll get to that maybe in time, what he does with that very concept. But anyway, I'm always giving you more than you wanted to know. I'm thinking about starting a podcast called More Than You Wanted to Know. What do you think about that?
I like Sounds great. Yeah, so I'll just to add my own two cents here. I have seen Van Til, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I remember Van Til talking about presupposing the Christian worldview as a unit. And Bahnsen talks about presupposing
Page one. Page one.
okay, so you can confirm that.
Yep, page one.
Yeah, and then Bahnsen seems to follow suit. And again, I'm most familiar with Bahnsen, and I'm most familiar with him from this text that you're referring to here. And in here, he clearly says that what we're presupposing is the entirety of Christian revelation, like the whole thing, the Word of God as given. And this just is super. First of all, it's a massive claim, and it's just super vague, and it makes me wonder, in the act of presupposing, what exactly are we, because the Bible's 66 books, not all of it is theological in nature. I mean, there's genealogies and there's poetry and there's narrative. Are you telling me that all of this has to be presupposed as an epistemological precondition for rationality? Like,
Yeah,
what in your
I've often
experience,
wondered
Richard?
what, how would the epistemology just crumble to the floor if you took out 3 John or Nahum? Yeah, I've never understood why they thought that was the case. And at least the presupposition of God is a necessary precondition. Okay, I can deal with that. I don't think that that's exactly true, but I can. But yeah, the whole system. In fact, that comes up in the debate with Sproul and Bahnsen. And Sproul presses him on that, like, well, you make it sound like it's a one and done kind of thing. But when he presses Bahnsen, Bahnsen's like, well, how does this answer this question? Oh, well, you want me to go through, and here's the problem with the empiricists, and here's the problem. He's like, well, wait a minute, you just said it was one and done. It's the whole thing. So why would you have to deal with each separate worldview that you find in conflict with Christianity? Why would you need to do that if your one model answers everything? So even Bahnsen, I think, hinted that it's not really true. You don't really have to do the whole system.
And I think they have to make this bold claim, right? Because one of the criticisms against classical theism is that the arguments from classical theism don't get you to the triune God of Christianity, right? So they have to argue that their form of apologetics, their methodology, gets you all the way there, right? What you,
And
it just doesn't get
they
you.
accuse us of defending a generic theism, and so yeah, because it doesn't include the Trinity. No, exactly.
So this question of what exactly has to be presupposed is just a really foggy one in my own mind. I'm just not clear on what I'm, if I'm a presuppositionalist, what am I supposed to presuppose as the necessary conditions for the possibility of rationality or the intelligibility of the universe?
Now tell me, let me switch the tables here and ask you guys a question, because I don't know if my observation is right or not, but I suspect that when you get into a discussion in a debate, let's say, with a presuppositionalist over method, that many presuppositionalists are so convinced that their presuppositional apologetic method is entailed necessarily by their Reformed theology, that when you argue against the presuppositional method, in their mind, you're trying to disabuse them of their entire Reformed theology. And yeah. That's why they're so tenacious about the method. And you would think that they would take a cue from the counterexample of a R.C. Sproul, for example. And now it's even more when you got people like Richard Muller or J.V. Fesco or Keith Matheson.
James Dolezal.
James Dolezal, exactly. And then you go back in history, as Muller does with his deep dive into post-Reformation Reform Dogmatics four-volume set. And you start seeing people like Peter Martyr Vermilye, even some of the Institutes of Calvin. And you know, if you can pick and choose, even Turretin in a way, even Bovink. Now, those guys are a little bit more blurry in my mind. But nevertheless, you would think they'd take a cue from the fact that, well, there have been a lot of people who are unabashedly Reformed, Dordian even, though not all of them. But they're not presuppositional in their method. So,
that's right.
But I think that as an emotional thing, maybe, that's why they're so tenacious. Because in their mind, they hear us trying to disabuse them of all their Reformed theology. You go, no, I may not necessarily disagree with some of your Reformed theology. That's not necessarily the debate. But they do think it's entailed by it. So as a modus tollens, you negate the consequence. You got to negate the antecedent.
Well, I guess Andrew and I would be counterexamples, right, Andrew? I mean, we both lean Reformed theologically, but we're both classical in terms of our apologetics method. So,
and then lean quite as much as you guys do.
Well, you know, I would say that presuppositionalism as a methodology comes kind of late in history. It's kind of a late comer, and we can talk about this later, but I think it's largely, as you've already kind of indicated, Richard, it's largely in reaction to a certain philosophy that began to take root in the Western world. And I'd like to explore the philosophical roots of the presuppositional approach. But Andrew, do you have any thoughts or other questions for Richard?
Well, in part, in answering the question of, you know, the critique of the Reformed tradition being like these people will perceive that we are critiquing the entirety of Reformed theology. One of the things I like to point out about even with Francis Turretin is, where does Francis Turretin get his definition of theology? Well, he gets it directly from Aquinas. And so one of the things is, when you have guys like K. Scott Oliphant in this book, he doesn't like presuppositionalism, so he calls it covenantal apologetics instead. He says, for example, on page 81, no, sorry, 79 to 80, he refers to the God of Thomas Aquinas with a small g, and he's saying that the Christians should not actually be following that God, that this doesn't actually get us to God. This is kind of illustrating something that, Richard, you already pointed out. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I'm continually struck by is, you know, Anthony, I think this might be the case for you too. When I'm having these conversations with people, I mean, I think I'm known a little bit around my community for being a little bit rabidly Reformed. Like, you know, I'll quote the chapter and verse of the Institutes. And so people know that I'm not anti-Reformed. And yet there still is that kind of uncertainty, I think, about where I stand. It's almost like I must be corrupted Reformed, something like that. And when you cite something like Aquinas or something like Turretin there, where he's saying Aquinas is good, we get our definition of theology from Aquinas, it's almost like the very fact that you've broken with presuppositionalism means that you are corrupted, and therefore, even if you bring out a legitimate citation, don't give it any credence. Just ignore it because I'm still corrupted and I'm just spreading my lies, you know, kind of thing.
Oliphant apparently had drifted even during his writing career, because his earlier Faith and Reason book, he's singing Aquinas's praises, particularly on simplicity. He says there's no better definition in defense of simplicity than you find in Thomas Aquinas. And knowing some students who studied under Oliphant during that transition, something seemingly happened where he went from fairly sympathetic to a lot of Aquinas's classical theism to thinking Aquinas was the fallen angel or whatever, and just really eschewed a lot of his thinking. I know a student who was there during that time who tells the stories. It's like, yeah, you know, he got out just in time, graduated with his doctorate, because I think a lot of what he was doing and saying and writing was sympathetic to Aquinas as well. And he realized, boy, there's a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph, except it's the same Pharaoh
Yeah.
went from loving Joseph to hating Joseph. So it's really kind of strange. We're not really sure what the backstory is. And that doesn't make any one or the other position false. I'm not
Sure.
suggesting that. I'm just saying it is, if you read earlier in his earlier works, at least that Faith and Reason one, it's very, very different tenor than you get later on, especially when you get to his little monograph he wrote on Aquinas. I'm not here to beat up on Scott Oliphant. He's a great guy and he's an incredible researcher and he's always been nice to me. But if you've never read that, I guess it was Crossway that did. I don't know if you guys have read that little monograph on Aquinas. If you do,
No.
read it. Read Richard Muller's book review of it. It's bloody. It's bloody. Yeah.
Yeah.
At any rate,
Well,
sorry.
before we conclude here, I'd like to get your guys' thoughts on just the state of play in terms of the presuppositional method, even within the Reform community. But we'll visit that at the end. But it seems to me, and I don't really have my finger on the pulse, my ear is not to the ground, as probably you guys are probably more familiar what's going on in the broader, I don't know, Reform community. But it seems to me that there's something of a revival of Thomism that's happening amongst Reform thinkers. Again, I can point to the reception of thinkers like James Dolezal and Stephen Duby and others who are really, I don't know, it's almost like their views are pushing in towards mainstream. So I don't know what your guys' thoughts on that, but we could save that till the end as part of an assessment of where we think the state of play is in terms of presuppositionalism within Protestantism. But if we could, I want to, with the time we have remaining, I want to push right to the heart here of the presuppositional approach. This is obviously a huge subject. We can't hope to exhaustively address it in our limited time. So, Richard, let me throw this out to you. What would you say is the primary and fundamental distinguishing commitment of the presuppositional perspective? If you think there's one, or maybe there's two or three, but what would you say is kind of the theoretical hill that they're willing to die on, and that really distinguishes them as a apologetic system?
I think one of them that comes to mind immediately is as how they take Romans 1:18 and following about whether all men suppress the truth in unrighteousness, and that is the foundation on which they build their animus in principle, but not, as I've said, in practice, their animus to the idea that it would be legitimate to engage the lost man on neutral ground. That's a term that gets thrown away. James Anderson from Reformed Seminary talks about the sort of pillars, there's no neutrality and there's no autonomy, that those are both anathema. And so because to grant a neutral ground is, in their view, to tacitly say, is to tacitly deny the fall, the noetic effects of sin, that the lost man is in rebellion against God. Now I have an eccentric interpretation of Romans 1:18. Not that I don't agree with the indictment on the human race in rebellion against God, but I'm not so sure that verse says what they think it says. That may be an eccentric thing, and you might not be interested in my take on that. But that's one. They would say, look, any kind of apologetic method that explicitly or even tacitly grants neutral ground is to tacitly concede anti-God. As Van Til said, any argument that doesn't start with the presuppositional method, any God that's proved by their argument cannot be the God of the Bible. He cannot be the conclusion of an argument. He has to be the fountainhead of argument itself, the Trinitarian God. So that's one. And again, that's grounded in a fairly solid view in Reformed theology about the noetic effects of sin and about just the fall. Total depravity, I guess, would be more directly connected. That's one of them. And then I think maybe connected to it is the other pillar that James brings up, and that's the idea of autonomy. So Ken Ham likes to say it this way. I realize Ken Ham is not a stellar thinker in these regards, but he's very unambiguous, and he always juxtaposes man's word and God's word. right? So if you don't ground everything ultimately in some exegetical move, then it's man's work, which would mean then if you come to an argument with, say, some metaphysical precept about, say, the essence-existence distinction or form and matter or act and potency, which don't seem to derive from some clear verse of scripture, then that's man's word, and that's a tacit concession to man's autonomy, to use a Kantian phrase. So I see those hills. Interestingly, if I'm right about that, interestingly, it's another example of the fact that they see the method as just part and parcel of reform thinking itself.
Yeah.
But I mean, nobody, there's, you know, R.C. Sproul's second to no one in his Calvinism. He was a 5-point Dortian Calvinist, and the fall and the noetic effects of all of that. So he's like a burr in the saddle for them, because he's so anomalous. Like, he didn't go to Westminster for seminary, so he didn't study under the Van Til or any of his disciples. He went to Pittsburgh Seminary and studied under John Gerstner, who was a classical apologist and stuff. So thank God for R.C. Sproul. I think I learned as much philosophy from R.C. Sproul than just about any other source.
Yeah, R.C. Sproul had a huge impact on my own life. He's the guy who really got me interested in both theology and philosophy, because he was just such a great model of that. So Andrew, what do you think? So do you see any particular idea as being the fundamental idea that defines presuppositionalism?
Yeah, in addition to the two that Richard listed, which I don't think those are the two. There's not really, like, you covered all the bases. I don't really need to add anything. But if there was one that just sort of is a nice clarifying term to add to them, is the term transcendental. Because the big argument that Van Til is going to put forth is called the transcendental argument. And this gets into one of the ambiguities we were talking about earlier, because you have the idea of either God or a systematic theology that is what must be presupposed, right? The triune God or a systematic theology. And it's not overly clear to me that you can really, that you can conflate these two without, one, without having serious theological problems, but then two, they're just not the same object, right? So, and it makes a difference which one you're presupposing. If you presuppose just God, then you have the Kantian model for actually the transcendental argument, which is Van Til's big argument, was first put forth by Immanuel Kant probably about like 8 or so years before he published the first Critique of Pure Reason. So the transcendental argument in that sense actually still deduces God as the highest, most transcendental point of consciousness. However, we must keep in mind there's three different terms that are operating here. One is going to be transcendent, one is going to be transcendental, the other is going to be immanent. And so in the sort of philosophical language game that's going on here, if we're talking about what's immanent, we're talking about what's within consciousness, basically the content of consciousness right now. We're talking about presuppositionalism. So our discourse on presuppositionalism would be immanent to our consciousness. The transcendental would be the framework of that consciousness, and the transcendent would be what's beyond it. The analogy I like to use is that you have a house, you have what's inside the house, that's the immanent, you have the walls of the house, which is the framework of it, that's the transcendental, and then you have what's beyond the house, that's everything outside, right? Clearly, the transcendent and the transcendental are not the same thing. And if you conflate the two, that's a big problem. And so if you actually say that your deduction here is a transcendental deduction of God and that he is the highest transcendental point, then you've deduced still something that's just the framework of human consciousness. You have not actually made it to God, unless you are then going to conflate God into this human consciousness. So there's a little bit of a crudeness with language that starts showing up here. And to be fair to Van Til, a lot of people made that mistake around that time. I hate to say it. I think I've even found a place where Jacques Maritain, the great Thomist, actually makes that mistake, which crushes me. But anyway, the thing is, though, the noetic effects of sin point, I don't think there's any historical justification for it whatsoever in the Reformed tradition before Abram Kuyper. And so Abram Kuyper is late 19th century. He's into the early 20th, I think. And he is a politician, philosopher, theologian. Early in his career, he's a liberal theologian. Was very heavily influenced by the German philosopher Schelling, as well as the Romantic theologian Friedrich Schleiermacher. And the thing about these guys, now Kuyper then moves away from that. He becomes very much a conservative, sort of like a bulwark of the burgeoning conservative Calvinist movement that goes forward. But he gets a lot of, but one of the things that Kuyper was hoping to do was to synthesize Calvinism with this kind of German idealist tradition. Now, that synthesis is not what presuppositionalism is, because I don't think it really uses the terms of, you know, the German tradition very well. However, it sort of was the place where these terms start getting read into the Reformed tradition. And precisely because of that, I think the notion of the noetic effects of sin gets generated. Because you can appeal to, planting is the main one I'm going to think of when I think of the noetic effects of sin getting any kind of like detailed explication. Kuyper has references to something like this. I don't think he uses the phrase. But you go back to somebody like Calvin, and the original five chapters of the Institutes, book one, are, I think Michael Horton well describes them as a running commentary on Cicero's On the Gods. And everything that he's talking about is already there. If you go back and read Cicero on that, it's very clear that Calvin's just riffing off of what Cicero's talking about. But guess what's happening in Cicero? Well, not any epistemological concern, right? Epistemology isn't a concern really until the turn of modernism, which is with really Descartes is a good place to draw that line. And Descartes didn't write the book that launched this thing until 80 years after the final edition of the Institutes was penned. And the stuff that gets considered like the grounding of this epistemological point in Calvin was actually written several editions before that. So we have a century of a difference of Calvin prior to the emergence of this to this modernist project that would give rise to questions about the noetic effects of sin, transcendentals, and stuff like that.
Yeah. So let me ask, if I may.
Sure.
Just a technical point. I don't know how much Van Til wrote in Dutch versus English. So in terms of the distinctions of the terms, could someone explain that as well? You know, you're talking about English translations of the German and or the Dutch. And so is there a one-to-one correspondence in the terminology? Or is that even relevant? Because Van Til, for example, wrote these things we're talking about in English anyway, so it kind of doesn't matter.
All the ones that are relevant that I know of are in English. And okay. The standard refrain that Van Tilians are going to use is something to the effect of, well, he wasn't very good at English. You know, his wife actually wrote a lot of his stuff for him because he just wasn't very, you know, his English wasn't very good. So a lot of the lack of clarity in him, what are really, to my mind, the really bad blunders that he makes that get kind of washed away by saying, oh, it was just a problem of language. But the problem is, even if we go to like German for transcendental, I mean, the German for transcendental is the word transcendental, just spelled with like a Z in there, right? So it's still transcendental. Like, it's still the same sorts of terms.
And well, I don't I know more German than I thought I did then.
Yeah, right. So there's things like that where, you know, and I don't think Van Til even uses the phrase noetic effects of sin. He might. That's more people, I think, bringing Plantinga in to try to make sense of him. But yeah, I don't think there's any real salvation for him in that.
But don't you see what the presuppositionalist does here? Don't you see it as a false dichotomy? I mean, it's almost like they're telling us either the noetic effects of sin are total, right? Or else we're all autonomous rational beings.
Right.
Like it seems like they're offering us that dichotomy. Choose one or the other. Either you are totally gone in your thinking and you know, your intellectual capacities are completely marred and disfigured by sin, or when you reason, if you think you have any intellectual capacity left after the fall, then you're just acting autonomously and trusting your reason.
It's very interesting that just recently I saw a conversation between Keith Matheson and James Anderson. Forget which podcast they were on as guests. Some you guys may remember what it was. But basically, the podcaster had Keith on to talk about Keith's book on Van Til, and James on as sort of defending Van Til. So it's a very, very productive conversation. And this comes up because Keith had criticized what seemed to be an inconsistency in Van Til, namely, like, for example, you can get a quote from Van Til in his My Credo, we, meaning the Christian, we do not believe that you, the unbeliever, know any fact of reality truly about anything.
Yeah.
And you go, okay, well, that's pretty radical. But then other places, especially when you look at the answer the fool according to his folly, you assume for the sake of argument, or even more explicitly, Van Til saying, of course, the unbeliever can know how to count or whatever. You go, okay, well, I thought he didn't know any fact of reality truly? So that antithesis, James tries to show how he thinks it's consistent in a under a broader overarching point about Van Til. I'm not sure I understood that because the conversation to me I got distracted because the conversation went from whether that's a legitimate observation of Van Til, and then second, whether it's reconcilable. It went from that to whether or not Keith, in his critique, factored either or both of those in his critique. And so James' criticism was that you were selective about which of the antithesis you focused on to make your critique. And he said you should try to, you know, I thought, okay, I need to go back and hear it again. Maybe you guys know more about that. But I think it is an inconsistency.
Yeah.
Where, like this false dichotomy, because in sometimes how could you even do, as Bonson says, the impossibility of the contrary. So you try to show the lost man that the contrary to the Christian worldview is impossible. Well, how would you show that if he's not able to even know any fact of reality? Truly, he wouldn't even be able to know.
If he's unable to reason because of sin.
That's right.
What's the point of trying to reason with him?
I'm sorry, I'm talking on top of you.
No, I was just saying, what's the point of trying to reason with him?
Say that again, because I keep talking on top of you. Sorry.
I was just saying, what's the point of even trying to reason with somebody if, you know, noetically, sin has just completely effaced their rationality?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This may be something for another podcast, but I was just startled listening to James Anderson give his, you know, with the two pillars and such. And he makes comments like, well, you know, the presuppositionalists would say that the lost man, or actually anybody, no one fails to come to any topic or any assessment of any claim or anything without their prior presuppositions / worldview. And that it's through that they do all their interpretations of what's going on. I go, well, then how would you be able to know? Again, I may be jumping ahead. If the presuppositionalist goes, well, the lost man's worldview, let's just use that term, can account for X, Y, and Z. Well, no, you don't know whether his worldview does or doesn't account for X, Y, and Z. All you know is that your worldview interprets it that they can account for it. Maybe they do account for it, but you're not able to objectively see it because your worldview doesn't give you what he calls neutral. There's no neutral ground. I go, well, there's a difference between neutral and common ground. Second, go back and listen to it, or not go back, but go listen to it. His defense of there is no neutral ground sounds to me like he's rejecting objective knowledge of reality, that no one has objective knowledge. Everyone only has the knowledge that arises out of their prior worldview. Again, that would be why it's presuppositional, because it's antecedent to everything downstream.
That's right.
And I go, well, it's a postmodern relativism is what it boils down to, which I know that's not what he wants to say. In fact, that's what bothers me. Is I know that's not what he's saying or wants to say, but that's what he is saying, it seems to me.
It seems like, according to their view, we are all like hermetically sealed in our own worldview bubbles, right? And there's no overlap of these bubbles. So if that's the case, if our worldviews entirely control how we interpret and value the facts, or what we even count as facts, as you point out, Richard, how in the world can we even evaluate the view of someone else who's inhabiting a completely different worldview bubble, right? How can we even try to reason with that person to show them that their worldview is inconsistent, or that
one thing I haven't read is Van Til's Common Grace in the Gospel. I've had it for years, but I've never pulled it off the shelf to actually read. Apparently, that's relevant to this very discussion.
Okay.
In terms of what they are committed to in principle, and then how that translates into practice. I think it's the Common Grace in the Gospel that gives rise to what Matheson and Anderson were talking about, this sort of antithesis or this conflict. I'm not sure it's resolvable. I think it just becomes, and that's why in practice they actually don't follow through on that.
Yeah,
they actually do think the lost man does know how to count, and that the sky's blue on a sunny day and things like that. And then they'll just say, well, it's inconsistent with their worldview. And I go, okay, but to say that their belief about X, Y, and Z is inconsistent with their anti-theism is just to do classical apologetics. That's exactly what classical apologetics does, is try to show how you couldn't ultimately account for these things were it not for certain truths that we know from theism and then more specifically Christianity.
Yeah, and if you let the common grace foot in the door, it seems like the classical apologist can just push his way all the way in, because once you have any common ground, once you have any worldview overlap that you can appeal to in an argument for the existence of God, it seems like you can run the whole classical method, right? I mean, it's like, it seems to be an all or nothing game that they have to play.
That's right. And I just don't think it's true in the sense in which the presuppositionalists with whom I'm familiar have said that everyone suppresses the knowledge of God. I mean, if you follow the argument in Romans 1, he talks about, it's really, I don't want to get into this unless you just want to, but it's really a matter of the syntax of whether you take who suppressed the truth and unrighteousness to be in apposition to all men. So I could say something like, you know, mammals, which are warm-blooded. Well, which are warm-blooded is just another way to say mammals, right? But if I said people who live in Atlanta who aren't Atlanta Falcon fans, well, who aren't Atlanta Falcon fans is not another way to say people who are in Atlanta. Who are not Falcon fan is a subset. So the question for the exegete, because it's not a grammatical issue, is whether or not a wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. Does it mean his wrath is against a subset of men who do that suppression? Or is he saying the suppression is to men like warm-blooded is to mammal? Yeah. I think the former is true if you go through the rest of his argument in Romans 1. Again, that's more than you want to do. That's
I know. I think that's interesting.
I'll do that but by isn't, myself.
But if it, even in Romans 1, doesn't it say that what can be known of God has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made? So even Romans chapter 1 seems to indicate that even though there's something going on here, some blinding effect, it's not intellectual in nature, because what can be known of God is clearly perceived. In fact, it should be so obvious that it's enough to make us all guilty before God, because we ought to see it. But it seems to
now,
me that
isn't
the
that a kind of the way their argument, though, in a way, they say, see, so ultimately apologetics just boils down to evangelism and efficacious grace. And so we preach the gospel, the Holy Spirit regenerates someone, they come to faith, and that's, it just sort of collapses into just an evangelism in a way, it seems like, because of, well, everybody knows this, so you don't really need to argue it. They don't do that, but it seems like that would be the ultimate, like, oh, let's just retire apologetics and just preach the gospel. That's all we need to do, and the Holy Spirit will efficaciously redeem his elect.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a separate question. I mean, the only point I'm making here is that I don't think you can look, I think it's obvious to me from Romans chapter 1 that the problem with the unbeliever is not that he doesn't see God. It's not that he has some problem with his intellectual faculties, but rather the problem's with the will. It seems like a spiritual problem, that he suppresses what he knows to be the truth. And it's a further question about the efficacy of apologetics, but at least it seems to me that you can't deny from a scriptural perspective that the lost man doesn't know stuff. Like, where do you get that from the Bible? You certainly don't get that from Romans 1. Andrew, did you want to jump in here?
Yeah, a couple of things. One, the podcast that you were talking about was since I now a student, that was Kevin DeYoung's podcast that debate happened on.
Yeah, good. Yeah. That's right. I remember now.
Yeah, and it was So one of the points as well that you're pointing to with it seems like there's an epistemological problem that they're not properly resolving. It doesn't seem like they can. Weirdly, and I almost never will ever plug this guy, but Wilson, I think, Doug Wilson came up with a good phrase that I think kind of helps clarify. Now, here's the problem. He came up with the phrase, I'm sure there's 10 other Vantillians that you can quote or presuppositionalists who will say something else, because it seems like this is just a vague point. But what Wilson said is men know a lot of things without knowing how they know, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not the question of just knowledge per se, but the groundwork of knowledge, which gets us to the transcendental question again. You go to somebody like James Anderson, he's going to follow Plantinga, and he's going to talk about noetic structures, and he's going to point to propositional grounding. So proposition A is grounded on proposition B, and so on and so on. And so the inference is going to be that, well, eventually there has to be a grounding proposition, or else everything's just free floating and doesn't actually have any basis.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's one approach. The other is more the transcendental proper, which I think is more what Van Til probably has in mind, which is really to talk about really the Kantian term of the transcendental. And the transcendental here, again, is the framework of understanding. The problem is you can't get to the transcendental qua transcendental. You have to make a deduction to get to it. You have to make an inference to get to it. The transcendental never makes itself manifest on the content. It's the ground of the content. You only know the content, right? Mm. So there's that kind of a point that's considerably different from a propositional framework wherein you have to know the proposition. You know, so these are two different kind of approaches that I haven't really seen properly resolved, but mainly that's probably because a lot of this has to do with people that are not really very much, and they even make kind of a point of pride about this, that it's not, they're not trained philosophers, they're trained theologians. Philosophy, yeah. Good philosophy, a lot of times they'll say, reduces to theology. And that's another sort of objectionable claim. I think, you know, theology needs its own domain. Proper, don't reduce it to all these other subjects, but the also philosophy needs its own domain.
Absolutely.
And the thing is this question of how they know, well, that is the epistemological question, but that doesn't remove the fact that someone can know. How someone knows is not it isn't a per se refutation that they know. And so I think when you start getting to the debate over the non-believer knowing something true about God, the person might actually genuinely have a true knowledge. They might have perceived correctly. They just cannot give a proper justification for it in their epistemological categories. However, that would formally, to my mind, only work on the basis of a propositional account. They can positively know the propositions that they believe to be true. They just can't give, you know, all the way down to the formal propositional ground that they need, right? That, you know, the triune God exists and caused everything, right? Causes and sustains everything. So that would be on sort of this Plantingian propositional grounding approach. The problem, though, is if Van Til's talking about the transcendental, again, that's a very, 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 very different claim. This is an entirely different model all of a sudden. And if that's the case, we're talking about a transcendental unity of consciousness, the very zenith point of consciousness where it is sort of grounded in this thing that's unreachable, the transcendental unity. And in that regard, if that's what's marred, then it has to follow that we can't know anything at all ever, period. Like it's not really a question of men knowing a lot of things without knowing how they know. The reality is, if the transcendental is what's marred on a Kantian model, which seems to be what Van Til's importing, I shouldn't say it seems to be. He says he's importing it, right? So if that's what's marred, then literally knowledge itself in its positive content becomes impossible. And so these are two different claims, and it seems like there's a lot of just ambiguity in terms of which one.
That's right, yeah.
Do you think, is it relevant at this point what Van Til talks about his understanding of analogy?
Yeah.
Where human knowledge is a microcosm of God's knowledge, but I mean, it's real different from what analogy had been.
Completely different.
Yeah, which I don't know if he was aware that it was, not that people can't use whatever word they want to use, but for the sake of clarity, it would be unfortunate to use a term that had been used so thickly in epistemology, if you will, since the scholastics, all of a sudden just use the same word for something just totally. But I don't know if you thought, Till thought, that would be his way out, is this importing this kind of eccentric notion of analogy to deliver knowledge in some finite microcosm of God's knowledge, or it may not be relevant at all.
I think it is
spitballing here.
Yeah, I think it is, because I think, like, for him, it would be, as I understand him, and this is also, again, a lot of this comes through, you know, reading, like, James Anderson has a really good article on this called "If God Then Knowledge," and a pre-published form is available on his website if anybody, you know, listening is wanting to read it. But anyway, it seems to me like what Van Til has in mind is a quantitatively different approach to what's qualitatively the same in terms of knowledge. And this is just sort of when I'm talking about, there's a kind of crudeness to the way they use philosophical terms. This is kind of one of those places, right? Because the Thomist, in a Thomist doctrine of analogy, the example I like to give is that when I say that I know my brother, right? I have a dog as well. My dog knows my brother. Those are both true statements, but they're not true in the same way. My dog knows my brother truly in the way that's appropriate for a dog. And this is not quantitatively different from me in terms of how many propositions the dog has affirmed. It's
Right.
just what's proper to the dog. I, however, know my brother in a properly human way, which can be expressed propositionally. Meanwhile, there's a qualitative difference between me and the dog's knowledge. And so there's an analogical link, but it's a qualitative difference that's being linked, not a quantitative one. Well, infinitely more so when you compare our minds with God's mind, if you will, our rationality with God's rationality, because God doesn't know in the way that we know, because he's infinitely different and above us. In the same way that we're infinitely above the dog, he's infinitely above us, which is to say that qualitatively, his mode of knowing is different from our mode of knowing as human beings. And so if that's the case, and I think that that's pretty easy to defend, not only, just from a systematic theological standpoint, that has to be easily defended. And if that's what's going on in a doctrine of analogy, classically construed, then when we approach Van Til, what it seems like is that God has a comprehensive propositional understanding of the world, right? That God has a comprehensive totalizing understanding of everything, right? And so it's not qualitatively different. It's that he has, one, no negative propositions that he's affirmed, and two, all of the positive propositions that he's affirmed. He knows everything in a totalizing sense, but it's not qualitatively different. And in that sense, that would be another point where I would point to, this is just an echo of the fact that this is a view thoroughly inundated or grounded in a modernist way of understanding consciousness. Because in modernism, yeah, God and man, reason just became this one capital R thing. God reasons, man reasons, we're doing the same thing. And right. So therefore, it takes you all of about 5 seconds. There's a really great book called Evil in Modern Thought by Susan Nyman. And she opens up by noting that there's a King Alfonso X that has a tutor. And King Alfonso's tutor is explaining to him sort of how God created the cosmos. And they're explaining it in this sort of high rationalist enlightenment sort of mentality or mode. And so we can understand why God did this. Think about this Leibnizian thing of, you know, there's a reason for every cause, and we can deduce the reason, and it has to therefore reduce to some human mode of comprehension. Right. And so King Alfonso then says, well, if I had been there at God's side by creation, we'd have done a lot of things differently. Well, the thing is, what Alfonso is not realizing is that his mode of knowing, his mode of understanding is completely categorically different from God's. And so, no, if you'd been at God's side, he'd have just ignored you because you're an idiot by comparison. Right. Like, this isn't a quantitative difference. It's a qualitative difference. But in modernism, we see sort of the synthesis of the two. And so far as I can tell, they haven't really been properly split back since. Yeah. Except for the Thomistic response that we're seeing lately.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, just shows you how, and Anthony and I have discussed this in a prior podcast on how theology needs philosophy, which causes, people, some of the Van Tillians, to break out in a rash to somehow think that there's something antecedent. Go. All we're saying is you wouldn't be able to parse out even some of their own presuppositionalism. You wouldn't be able to parse that out without appealing to categories, which themselves you didn't get from Scripture.
Right.
So aren't really starting with God's self-revelation of the, 66 books of the Trinitarian Protestant Reformed Bible, right? You're not doing that because you use these categories that are philosophical categories. They may be good or bad categories, but my point is even weaker than that. They're just categories that themselves not only don't arrive from Scripture, but are necessary for you to even properly understand Scripture. Otherwise, you're going to come out with a God that looks like the Dake Study Bible, that God has all these body parts. You know, he has legs, hair, and ears and stuff. You go, well, you couldn't know those weren't anthropomorphisms without some antecedent reason to understand why God's being is different than creation. The creation distinction, as they say.
Yeah. Well, in a minute here, I want to try to look at some of the philosophical underpinnings, if we can, of presuppositionalism. But if I could back up for a minute, setting aside the question of the efficacy of apologetics from a presuppositional or a classical position, setting that question aside, it seems to me one of the frustrating things about dialoguing with the presuppositionalists is they equivocate on just what is the content of knowledge available to the unbeliever or the lost person. Because it seems like a lot of times, like even in this book, sometimes Bahnsen makes statements where it seems like he's saying that a lost person cannot know, can have no knowledge apart from presupposing the truth of Christianity, right? Unless Christianity is the epistemological precondition, it has to be the precondition for this kind of knowledge. But then other times he seems to equivocate and say that the problem is a spiritual problem. It's not that we don't have the knowledge. We can have access to the same knowledge. The problem is that the unbeliever suppresses that knowledge. So it seems to be a moral problem. So it's like they equivocate. Is it a intellectual problem? Is it a moral problem, a moral spiritual problem? Because right. if when they talk like it's an intellectual problem, you just want to do who was the guy who thought he could refute? I don't know why this is coming to my mind right now, but who is the guy who thought he could refute Berkeley's idealism just by kicking a rock? Right, he kicked the rock and he said, thus have right. I overturned Berkeley's idealism, right? Yeah. When the presuppositionalist makes this claim, it seems to say that we can have no knowledge, no genuine knowledge, apart from the presupposition of the Word of God. It makes me just want to take that person to an atheist convention, stop somebody on the way inside and say, hey, what's 2 + 2? And then they'll say 4, and I'll go, QED. Right, like there you go. Exactly. He's an atheist,
kicking the stone,
and he knows how to do math, right? So, but what's so frustrating is Bahnsen will like he'll say all these, he'll make these bold statements, but then later on he'll walk them back, and he'll say, well, really, what's happening is the unbeliever actually knows all this stuff. They have access to the same kind of facts and knowledge that you and I do, but they're suppressing it in unrighteousness. So what we do in apologetics is we try to bring to their remembrance the stuff that they know deep inside that they're suppressing, like holding a basketball underwater.
It's like Plato.
It's like Plato, right? It's like the theory of recollection. It's like Socrates and the Meno. Exactly.
I was going to say it's kind of like
I never noticed that until you made it clear just then. I never realized that. Well, that's kind of like Plato's recollection.
I was just going to say that. This is like the theory of recollection where Socrates is trying to demonstrate that the slave boy actually can do mathematics,
that's
even
right.
though
Meno.
He's never done it. That's right. Yeah.
Meno. Yes, absolutely.
Well, it's kind of like psychoanalysis too, in the sense that instead of like repressing, instead of suppressing the truth and unrighteousness, they are repressing the truth. Right. And so the whole point of the psychoanalytic process would be to make that manifest. And so it's sort of like that's what the Vantillian's trying to do in that regard. They're playing the analyst in that.
I really do believe in many respects to their detriment. Presuppositionalism is indebted to too many modern and contemporary analytic philosophical categories and data points.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, when they just. It's frustrating to me as a Thomist, and it shouldn't be, but it, you know, I already know this is the case, but it's frustrating when people will just say these things that are philosophical precepts that are pretty much everybody believes because almost everybody, I'm saying in the philosophical world, is analytic, at least in the U.S., and they just state that as if, well, that's just a given. Philosophers say that knowledge is justified true belief. I go, yeah, well, Aristotle doesn't say that, and Aquinas doesn't say that. Now, maybe they're wrong, but that never gets into the conversation. We all know these things. And I go, well, a lot of these things that we all know create the very problems that you think you need to solve.
That's right.
When Bahnsen in the debate with Gordon Stein, we listened to this as well in the class. At the end, I regret two things. One, it came at the end, so Stein couldn't come back, and he probably wouldn't have anyway. Second, Bahnsen... when he jumps on what Stein said, I would have picked a different example than what Stein did. But what happened was when Bahnsen was pressing him on the uniformity of nature, how do you know that the future is going to be like the past kind of thing? And Stein gave a response to the effect, well, for example, I know the nature of an electron and it will be negatively charged. It's always going to repel positively charged. In Bahnsen's closing, he says, Stein doesn't know the nature of an electron. To which I wished he would have been able to go, how do you know I don't know the nature of an electron?
Yeah.
You just assume I don't. Now, maybe I wouldn't have picked electron. I would have picked a macroscopic to say something about the nature of a human being. And then defy Bahnsen to go, well, Hal doesn't know the nature of a human being. I know the nature of them. You might not, but I know. But of course, the reason I can say I know is how I unpack what that means to know that is along these contours of this classical realism. Which they may reject that's fine, but that's never the debate. That's not the debate. It's just assume that, well, Hume was right. We can't really know these things, so let's rally, circle the wagons and create an apologetic method that tries to fend off all of these otherwise insuperable problems. They go, they're not insuperable problems.
No.
They never were problems until post modern philosophy and Descartes onward, in my judgment, except for one.
Earlier I asked about what do you guys think is kind of the fundamental claims made by presuppositionalists that really distinguish them. And I actually think it's an adherence to philosophical anti-realism. I think that it is anti-realism that truly distinguishes the presuppositional approach from all other classical methods, and however you want to break the classical method down between evidentialists and Thomists and so forth. I think it's the presuppositionalist begins by presupposing that some form of anti-realism is true. Because for the anti-realism, as opposed to, like, let's say the classical view of realism, when we know things, what we're knowing are not the things in the world, but something in our subjective experience, right? Whether that be ideas or appearances or what have you, right? It's something inside of ourselves that we are immediately knowing. And it's a small step from this view of knowledge, this anti-realist view of knowledge, to the statement and the belief that all of our knowledge is mediated by presuppositions, right? That all of our thinking is done through the lens of worldview. Because if you start off with an anti-realist epistemology in which we're never truly in contact with things in themselves, but only with ideas in our minds, well, it just seems naturally to lead into this worldview thinking that Van Til talked about, and the idea that all of our knowledge is a matter of the interpretive framework that we bring to bear on the facts of experience. What do you guys think it's a fair criticism to say that
I think that you're onto something there. I think, to be sure, being an anti-realist wouldn't be a sufficient condition for being a presuppositionalist. I mean, William Lane Craig is an anti-realist. But I think in the case of Craig, he goes on to affirm things in his epistemology that I don't see how they could be affirmed given that he's an anti-realist. So he talks about God's nature or other kinds of things. Like, you're trafficking in these categories that don't seem to arise or be consistent with your anti-realism. But aside from that, yeah, I think so. Again, it's a concession to a lot of contemporary analytic philosophy where maybe not an explicit anti-realism on some of the for some of the philosophers. It's just you've tabled the question of metaphysics altogether and trying to deal with epistemology as if it's a freestanding endeavor, and it never grounds itself in anything that's real. It always grounds
That's right.
itself. My criticism is a lot of times these epistemologies ultimately cash out questions of epistemology in the categories of epistemology. It's just this sort of internally bubble, like you were saying before. And so you can make a really airtight, internally consistent explaining the downstream points of epistemology by the upstream fountainhead categories of epistemology itself. In fact, that brings up the specter of circular reasoning. Right. And so the presuppositionalist will respond when we say, well, if you're presupposing God in order to prove God, that's a circular argument. To which they go, well, all reasoning is circular. I go, no, a classical realism is not circular. But they don't even see this. I don't think they see this, but I think that you're exactly right. They're tacitly affirming this kind of anti-realism because it's not the thing that I know directly. It's some kind of mediated. In fact, that's how they take the Romans 1 passage.
That's right.
The invisible attributes of God are clearly seen, being understood through the things that are made. Yet Oliphant is adamant that's immediate knowledge. I go, how do you get immediate knowledge with through the things that are made? That sounds like mediated, in some sense. And so I have an encounter directly with the sensible object, and it becomes one with the knower at the level of form. It's they're anti-realists. I think you're onto something there.
And I don't even think that you could have a presuppositional apologetic if you're a realist, because realism starts with the assumption that you know being, that exactly. what you know in the act of knowledge are beings in the world.
Absolutely. Right?
And if that's where we start as human beings, if we're in touch with things as they exist in themselves, then it just follows straightforwardly that we can make these classical demonstratio quia arguments, arguing from effect to cause. If we are in contact with things in the world, then you have the classical model right there, ready to hand. And absolutely. Yeah, so I think you have to be, although you, if you're an anti-realist, I don't think it's entailed that you have to be a presuppositionalist. But I do think that if you're a realist philosophically, you cannot be a presuppositionalist unless you import some other story to tell as to how the effects of sin somehow disconnect us from knowing things in themselves. You have to tell some metaphysical epistemological story. But anyway, what are your thoughts on that, Andrew?
Well, let me ask you this, just before you get away from that thought. It would seem like that it's plagued by the problem that they don't distinguish properly the will and the intellect. And given that they don't do that, then whatever one might say about the intellect would creep up on some kind of realism, because the intellect is going to be formally identical with the thing that's known in the realism. But if you just treat all of these questions about God as if it is a function of the will, then you don't have a category to put the realism in anymore. It's just a matter of, well, you're in rebellion against God, so it's a will problem, not an intellect problem. And you go, well, if it's not an intellect problem, then, I mean, they might say that it is, but I'm saying they reduce it to the will. But it's the intellect that introduces the metaphysics, because the That's intellect's right. formal identity with the thing known. Anyway, I didn't know
that's
if you
why I
said
you. That's why. That's why I say you can set the question of the efficacy of apologetics to one side, because the classical and the presuppositional, at least some classical Protestants, Reformed classical Protestants, are going to agree that the lost man has a will that is set against God, and that he will not accept the things of God unless God first regenerates him, opens his heart to receive the things of God. But that doesn't mean he can't understand and see the truth. You know, it's one thing to see the truth and understand the truth. It's another thing to, you know, place your trust in the truth, is to give yourself over to the truth. And what do the reformers say? There's a difference between notitia and fiducia, I think, is the distinction that they made. So anyway, you know, even the classical apologists can admit that we can't argue anyone into the faith. Even if we could convince somebody that, let's say, that their atheism is false, that God exists, that Jesus rose from the dead, we could do all of that, and they could rationally assent to all of that, but that falls short of that person actually becoming a Christian. That person has to make that personal decision to place their trust in Absolutely. Christ, right?
Absolutely. I've used the illustration, suppose a man is been injured sufficiently that he's in the hospital and he's bandaged up. Let's say maybe he got burned or whatever. He's going, so his senses are blunted. He can't hear quite as well because of the bandage. He can't see. And a woman comes in, identifies herself as his wife, and wants a kiss. And it would be reasonable for him to want evidence to know that she actually is his wife and not somebody trying to weasel her way and then get the credit card or whatever and run off, right? But if he had his senses about him sufficiently, and he knew that she was his wife, and he still didn't want to kiss her, then he's got a moral problem. Mm. He doesn't already know what it is to be the husband of a wife. That's not a noetic issue. That's a problem of a moral issue. And that distinction, I think, gets to the heart of what you just said. The classical apologist isn't saying we're strapped with the obligation to try to convince a husband to love his wife. You go, if a husband doesn't know to love his wife, he's got a problem a lot deeper than apologetics can solve.
That's right.
But if a husband isn't sure which of these women out here is actually his wife, then there may be a place for giving evidence to say, no, she's an imposter. You know, she's a gold digger, whatever. This is your wife. Oh, okay. And from that point, you know, it's between the two of them and stuff. So I think there's an analogy there to the apologetic endeavor.
Well, and there's something quite... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
was going to say there's something quite humorous about like the example here. It for the presuppositionalist, salvation really seems, I mean, there is obviously there's going to be the platitudinous response of obviously it's putting your trust and your faith in Jesus. Yes, everybody knows this. Everybody reaffirms this. But structurally, what does it look like? Does it look like just truly affirming the Christian worldview? Is that the case? Because we have a very interesting example going on in culture right now. Anthony and I just talked about Jordan Peterson's new book for several episodes. And Jordan Peterson openly and explicitly even affirms what he will call the Christian, what is it, the Christian corpus, which is the foundation, the Bible, which is the foundation of all knowledge, right? He affirms this. He even was pressed and was like, I probably think that, yeah, Jesus rose from the dead. And yet I'm pretty sure we all know that he's not a Christian, right? He doesn't seem to actually be. So he fits all the criteria for this presuppositionalist model, it seems like, yeah. And yet he's not actually somebody who probably, at least so far as we can tell, is a Christian.
Yeah, and nobody's claiming that apologetics can convert anybody. Like, nobody's right. Even making that claim. But I would go even further, and I would say we also shouldn't make the claim that evangelism converts anybody. Right? Mm-hmm. Nothing we say, no matter whether we're preaching the gospel, or arguing for, the rationality of the Christian worldview, you can't ever talk anybody into the kingdom of God. Everybody agrees that this is the work of the Holy Spirit on somebody's heart. So, you know, yeah, you can't argue someone into the kingdom, but you can't preach someone into the kingdom either. It takes the Holy Spirit.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Can I return to that anti-realism point?
Sure.
No.
Yeah, one of the more frustrating things, I think, in terms of that question is we like to frame it in terms of anti-realism versus realism, right? And I put, and I like using the word frame there because it's a bit of a pun, because I'm pretty sure it was John Frame who gave this response. And the response was, I might have the wrong person, but I think it was John Frame. The response was that the Christian is neither the presuppositionalist Christian here is neither a realist nor an anti-realist. He is a Christian. Which to me is again kind of like a category mistake. What do you mean? Like, what we're saying is there an immediate knowledge with me and the thing that I know, or is it mediated by some sort of transcendental structure impeding me, and so I only know through a certain lens? That's the question of realism and anti-realism. Am I directly knowing it, or am I indirectly knowing it through something that conditions my knowing? To the degree that the presuppositionalist is saying the things that I think we've outlined that they're saying, they have to be anti-realists. By that definition, but the response was, well, no, we're not anti-realists because that's secular philosophy. And again, this is just sort of a massive category error that is just one of many that keeps popping up here, and it shows up in a number of different places. Because Richard, you brought up the circular reasoning objection, which is one of the more common objections, and I think it was Frame again who and Vern Poitras, I think, that were the ones that proposed that answer that you gave, which is, well, everybody is guilty of circular reasoning.
Right.
And there's an article that they published, or I think it was Frame that published it in the Journal of Semiotics, which I'm particularly salty about because they rejected my article that I submitted that for that issue. But anyway, they published this article, or Frame published this article, wherein there was another just glaring category mistake in response to the circular reasoning point, because he says everybody is guilty of circular reasoning. However, that circular reasoning is only fallacious. This is almost a direct quote. He says circular reasoning is only fallacious if it is idolatrous circular reasoning. Now, what does that mean if not incorporating idolatry as a form or as a logical category? Right now, and that makes absolutely no sense. It makes no more sense than importing idolatry as a mathematical category. It's not a relevant category. And what it ultimately boils down to is he's essentially saying circular reasoning is only wrong when all the wrong people do it. But the right people, which is our group, is fine with doing that because you have to, because all reasoning is circular and you have to get off the ground. Well, that's funny, because you're getting out of one logical fallacy, if I even grant that you've gotten out of it, by now being guilty of special pleading. So now you're guilty of a second logical fallacy. And it's an amazing point there, because the category error of bringing in idolatry in terms of a logical category, that's already problematic. But now you're having this situation where to get off the ground, you must first be guilty of circular reasoning, and then you must defend that with a special pleading, right? And it seems like the presuppositionalist model is constantly saying all of the other systems cannot justify themselves without breaking all the laws of logic, and they can't justify the laws of logic, and they're guilty of all these fallacies here, 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 and here. But wait a second, shouldn't we apply the same standard here to the presuppositionalist model and point out that to get off the ground, again, you must first commit circular reasoning and then commit special pleading to defend it. And you're guilty of exactly something that should refute it. And to kind of move past that to the another point that I think is rather intriguing me lately, at least, is the kind of neutrality, like the anti-neutrality, right? This type of reasoning seems to follow, at least there's a kind of necessity that forces it upon people who deny that there is no neutrality. And that's a claim, like the neutrality claim. I was curious when that began, because you don't really find that in Hegel, for example, right? You don't really find that in Nietzsche even, right? And he was one of the ones that a lot of people like to go back to and say, oh, maybe it's Nietzsche. Well, he doesn't talk about neutrality, right? So where does this claim actually come from? The earliest I've found, and I hate to be the guy that just says, you know, totalitarianism and fascism and all that kind of stuff, but it actually emerges out of the debates in the early 20th century between the Bolsheviks and the fascists in Italy and Germany. What you find is there's a number of places where the Bolsheviks are saying, if you don't think in our proletariat terms, you're corrupted by bourgeois reasoning, and therefore, you know, they're entirely to be cast aside. Same thing with the fascists, basically, or the Nazis. Wherein there's actually a really great article I've got from, I think it's from 41 or 42, where it's an American who surveyed the Nazi education system, and a central pillar of it is explicitly the antagonism to neutrality that shows up there. And there's a quote that comes from a guy, Siegfried Mark, in an article called Neo-Machiavellianism and Ethical Nihilism, wherein he says, and I quote, "Neutrality is in itself a provocation against the totalitarian pretension. Now, am I claiming that presuppositionalism is totalitarian? No, he is. And he says,
I wanted you to say yes.
Yeah. Well, let me just read you what Van Til says. Van Til says, in every discussion about every fact, therefore, this is page 37. In every discussion about every fact, therefore, it is the two principles, that of a believer in Scripture and that of the non-Christian, that stand over and against one another. Both principles are totalitarian. Both claim all the facts. And so he kind of seems to be thinking it's an all or nothing game, precisely in this totalitarian sense. And that's another one of those words you might ask, you know, well, was this one that he just didn't know what the word meant? Well, I do know what the word in Dutch for totalitarianism is, and it's totalitarianism.
I know more Dutch than I thought.
Yep, there you go. Yeah, I'll throw that one in for free. But the thing is, like with that, I'm not trying to do the whole standard beware of him politically, kind of thing, but rather just to point to, there seems to be a political kind of discourse that takes over in the 20th century. Everybody seems to do this. If you turn to the postmoderns, interestingly enough, Terry Eagleton says that this no neutrality point in this book, he says that the no neutrality point is one of the hallmarks of postmodern thinking. But what is this no neutrality point? Well, it is a political point that becomes the ground of all discourse.
It's like they're making inferences from something that we would all affirm to be true that are just completely unwarranted inferences. I mean, when the scriptures do set up this strong dichotomy, the whole world, we are of God, but the whole world lies under the sway of the wicked one. So you've got the people of God and everybody else. That's legit. But to try to distill from that an apologetic method or other kinds of epistemology is just absolutely unwarranted, because no one would say on our camp that the people who are outside of the Christian faith and are under the sway of the wicked one aren't human. You know, they're somehow beasts. He's like, well, no, they're still human beings. So they still have faculties of knowledge and stuff to have. Yeah, so that very, very interesting.
It's interesting because you see, what it ends up reducing to is in-group is right and can speak about things. Out-group is wrong and can't speak about things. And we see that in the political discourse today. And it functions exactly the same, essentially, because like the Vantillian is not saying that you can't speak so much as they're saying you just can't speak rightly. You just don't know why you're I'm right and you're wrong, and you won't know how I'm right and you're wrong until you agree with me. And the thing is, like, you turn to a bunch of these slogans that are popping up. Jesus is Lord is the one that kind of gets thrown around. And so Doug Wilson will put it, Christ is Lord, therefore Caesar isn't, you know, that kind of thing. But you'll also have Joe Boot, I think, has a really great phrase. It's page 76 of his massive tome, The Mission of God, that one, right? And on that one, he says, all of life is religious. And that kind of struck a chord because I was like, wait a second, I've read something like that fairly recently. And, you know, just for kicks and giggles, I like to torture myself with my reading sometimes. And so I was curious about the old feminist phrase from the 60s and 70s that the personal is political. And I was looking it up to be like, okay, where does that come from? And there's a woman, Carol Hanisch, that says this in an article she wrote in 1969. And that statement, the personal is political, is her point. Now, what is she doing? She's taking exactly that no neutrality language, now applying that to the political or to the feminist cause. Interestingly enough, I found similar sorts of remarks in Frantz Fanon's talk about anti-colonialism, right? It's this entirely political. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to I'm thinking of theonomy when you bring this up.
Well, and that's Joe Boot.
Okay. Well, there you go. It seems to fall out that would be consistent with that whole theonomy talk. Not that every presuppositionalist is a theonomist. Bonson certainly was.
Yeah.
And I guess, I guess Doug Wilson is, I'm not sure, but
he is.
You know, so you can actually almost confirms your observations that, well, this stuff does fall out into every area of life in a certain particular way that entails this apologetic methodology.
Yeah, yeah. It's political. It functions politically is what I'm really just hitting at, and rather more than a rational discourse.
Basically, saying all presuppositionalists are Nazis. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah. Well, and I think there's the reason
that'll be the excerpt.
Yeah.
You know what? That's going to be the title of this video. This is going to be the title of this video on YouTube.
Well, I'm put it as a question mark. Are Van Tilly presuppositionalists Nazis? Question mark. Maybe he's talking about
Andrew thinks so.
Well, the thing is, I'm thinking of like Hegel has his famous master-slave dialectic, and he really gives you two options. You can either reason your way out of a struggle or you can fight your way through it. And if you can't reason your way through it, you only have the one option, right? There's just sort of struggle. And what happens with the destruction of this neutrality point that really seems to be, you know, functioning from a political animus or a political sort of way of thinking is the destruction of the ability to reason your way through it, as you guys keep pointing out, with your opponent. Your opponent is compromised before the discussion even starts if there's no neutrality. And so therefore, they are morally compromised and intellectually compromised, and you have to just do away with them. Thomism, for crying out loud, has a remark. Like Aquinas talks about the noetic effects of sin, or what we might call this, but it doesn't necessarily terminate in your opponent not having reason or anyone having reason.
That's
or
right.
Anything like that.
And we don't want to lose the point I think we made earlier, that they would, if they're listening to us and they're stomping their feet going, no, we do believe in answer the fool according to his folly, the impossibility of the contrary, we assume for the sake of argument, that, and they go on to do that. And I think, well, yeah, you do that, but it's not consistent with your method. You're actually just doing exactly what the classical apologist was already doing. So you might as well just retire your animus towards classical apologetics and just join, you know, get on the bus and join the team or whatever, because that's what you end up in practice doing is they actually do concede the point that you can reason about this because I can assume your point of view by the sake of argument and show you why it doesn't follow. Well, if you can do that, I guess he could reason after all, which you said he couldn't from your method.
Yeah,
that's right. Well, there are so many threads here that we could chase, so much more that we could talk about. But just being sensitive to time, I want to wrap this up for today. We might have to do a part two of this. But Richard, let me just kick this to you. As I said before, you have your ear to the ground on this. you're more intimately aware of you know, this discussion out there in the public sphere. What do you think is the state of play with presuppositionalism? Do you think it is it a waning paradigm? Do you think it's gaining more popularity? How do you assess the situation right now?
So I think there's a certain unavoidable artificiality built into any kind of question about how something might fare now versus earlier, precisely because of the onset of social media. So just about anything, even a bad idea that would have gotten no traction at all, gets more traction precisely because you're going to have somebody on YouTube touting that idea, and they'll get 150 followers. Okay, well, that's 149 more than it was 20 years ago, perhaps. So in that sense, I think presuppositionalism is faring fairly well because of some really attractive YouTubers. I like Eli Ayala, for example. He's my favorite YouTuber on for presuppositionalism. He's actually come to our conference as a he wasn't a speaker, but he was attending the conference. We've had lunch together. He's a nice guy, incredibly charitable, very thoughtful, that kind of stuff. So I think because of the winsome way in which some of this stuff can be marketed, in the good sense of the term marketed, it's seeing an increase of stability and stuff. And not to mention, you've got some younger guys who are pretty thoughtful, like a James Anderson. He's an incredibly careful thinker and a very incredibly careful speaker, though I disagree with him. And I think that fares well for this generation of presuppositionalists, in a way, reading Van Til like gargling peanut butter. And that's not a commentary that he's wrong. It's just saying it's difficult, and they even admit. So it would be hard-pressed if you were going to depend on Van Til's primary source for your well-being. It would languish a lot more than it is. But I think it seems to be doing pretty well. And it may be in sort of another artificial thing because I'm so interested in it. I pay attention to it. I'm geeky enough to be in the kitchen cleaning up and put on YouTube and just so presuppositionalism and then just pick and just let it go. And I'm listening, you know. So that may be more of a commentary on me than on the how well presuppositionalism is faring. But I think there's some thoughtful Jeff Durbin that are energetic and got a good following and stuff. So I don't think they're doing well as far as getting some attention. So the debate, I think, is more perhaps more there as well. I mean, I've made comments on YouTube that I've gotten a lot of presuppositionalists upset of. The thing I did with Cameron Bertuzzi years ago, I didn't give the title. He interviewed me for 5 minutes. And I didn't know what the subject. He started asking me questions. And I kind of off the top of my head. He puts it on YouTube. A refutation of presuppositionalism. It's like, no, I don't think I refuted it in 5 minutes. And they're all just slamming the fists on the table, going, anyway. So that's neither here nor there. But I think they seem to be doing well, and so the debate is lively, and it is definitely a family debate. I will say this in conclusion, though. You pick just any random assortment of presuppositionalists out there, and they will have more in common with a conservative, theologically conservative classical than a random assortment of a lot of classical apologists will have with other with this. So their theology, it really has set some safeguards about you're not going to find a presuppositionalist who's ambivalent about inerrancy of the Bible and creedal Christianity. And I mean, you're not going to find that, but you will find that among classical self-identified apologists who aren't particularly that interested in inerrancy of the Bible, or an orthodox understanding of the two natures of Christ, or a historical orthodox understanding of the Trinity. Yet they're classical evangelical apologists. Yeah. So kudos to the presuppositionalists for the guardrails that they have up.
Yeah, that's a good point to make. And quickly, Andrew, I know that you have some context within the Reform community more broadly. What are your thoughts on the state of presuppositionalism today?
I think I'm in the same algorithm as Richard. The YouTube knows what it knows what I watch, so it sends me all these new atheists, or not new atheists. That was not a Freudian slip either. All right, no, a bunch of presuppositionalist stuff. One of the things I find kind of interesting, though, is to that very same point, is that there is a kind of, you see like these internet groups that come together, and you have Wilson's probably the guy that's knocking out of the ballpark right now with his group, but then you have also groups like Right Response Ministries and so forth that have, you know, also have an indebtedness to Van Til, and openly so. And these groups kind of come together for a season and then they split apart pretty regularly. And so the one that just happened was, there's the big kerfuffle, Richard. There you go. The big kerfuffle
right
over
part. Glad you worked that in.
Yep. It's the great kerfuffle over what was called the Antioch Declaration, which I don't need to go into the details on that. But nevertheless, they kind of split. And the Right Response Ministries guys started following Stephen Wolfe, who wrote The Case for Christian Nationalism. And Stephen Wolfe brings in a lot of Aquinas. And that became a controversial point. So at the end of the Antioch Declaration, you have a statement, you know, like James White and Doug Wilson and Jeff Durbin, all these guys are signing the Antioch Declaration, really condemning a number of things. Anti-Semitism is the main one, but at the bottom, it's like everything Aristotle ever touched is condemned. And that caused actually, weirdly, a kind of rift in those circles, which you would have thought would have not been at all perplexed or bothered by the refutation of Aristotle. And that's precisely because I do think this Reformed Thomism has made its way through the Reformed community so very thoroughly that, at RTS, Kevin DeYoung in his Covenant Theology class regularly referred to Aquinas, right? And he even stopped and said, we should not, by the way, we should not just casually dismiss this guy. He's one of the greatest theologians of all times, right? You have this at RTS seminaries. You have this in Reformed leading authors right now all over the place. And it's
The Davenant Institute and the Davenant Publishing Company. Absolutely.
Exactly. And so that's having, I think, an interesting impact. And the two cannot be reconciled. The presup and the Thomistic Reformed Thomist cannot really come together. And the tensions, I think, are working their way out right now. I don't want to speculate on who's going to win.
Yeah, I was just going to say there is, I definitely sense a Thomistic revival in the Reform community. Like I said, you can point to giants like James Dolezal, Stephen Duby, but also Gavin Ortland, who has a huge YouTube presence, really popular channel, is a classical theist and not a presuppositionalist. So anyway,
does the divide, let me ask you this while I'm thinking about it. Does the divide track anything between the Paedo Baptists and Credo Baptists?
I don't know. No, I don't think so. I think they're, I don't think so. Yeah.
I know. I mean, Sproul was a Paedo Baptist, so.
Yeah, I think it's all Presby. I think it's all in the Presby groups that are kind of fragmenting.
You see a revival happening among Lutherans too. And the names of the guys I just had in my head have just eluded me. So Cooper, yeah, Jordan Cooper is one of them. He has also a big YouTube presence. So anyway, guys, thanks so much for coming on. This has been tons of fun. We may have to do a part two. We did go a little bit longer than we wanted to, so I apologize for that. But yeah, this has been great.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.